I'm so excited about this panel that you're going to have, this experience you're going to have in the next hour. I can't sit down. I have to stand up. This is a little unusual. They were telling me that they don't normally do it this way, and so this isn't going to be like other sessions that you've had. What they're doing is it's about the book, How Great Women Lead, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, and that sort of frames the discussion, and then these wonderful women that we have on the panel bring it to life. So it's sort of like you get to go on the journey. It's like you guys get to all be my daughter, and I get to take you on a journey with great women leaders. Isn't this cool? So I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves, and then I'll talk a little bit about the book, and then we'll get into the discussion. And we have the perfect people for this. This is so cool. So each one of you can introduce yourselves. We'll start with Alba.
Sure. Hi. Good afternoon, everybody, or good late morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I have a number of friends in the audience, and so I have to be on great behavior, or maybe not, but... So I was born and raised in Puerto Rico and came to the United States to go to law school at the age of 19 and went to Georgetown. And in Georgetown, I realized that my passion was to work in social justice. So after graduating from law school, I came to Philadelphia to work as a legal services attorney at Community Legal Services. And there I realized that while law was a great vehicle to achieve change, it took too long. So then I decided to move into some political work and nonprofit management. So I got involved in some political campaigns, and that led me to an opportunity to run a nonprofit called Congreso de Latinos Unidos that serves Latinos and others in the poorest neighborhood in the state of Pennsylvania. And it was an organization that was in deep trouble. So I was able to work with a lot of really committed people from inside and outside the community to turn that organization around. And I'm proud to say that it's a great, thriving organization today. And that led to the opportunity to be Commissioner of Human Services. And that is the head of the child welfare system in Philadelphia that has responsibility for foster care, abuse, neglect, and delinquency. So you'll see a running theme here. I always take jobs that nobody else wants, right? Like a declining nonprofit and then the toughest governmental agency. But that was an amazing job, and there we focused on reform, on achieving permanency for kids, and also restoring the credibility of this agency with its citizens. And then after that, that led to an awesome opportunity, the first job I really had to compete for, as president of United Way of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And that was a great job where we shifted to community impact funding model from a sort of legacy entitlement model. And 4 years ago, I joined Vanguard, my first private sector job in a great, great company that is client-owned. And at Vanguard, I work in the retail space. I'm a principal at Vanguard, and I have the honor of leading 600 crew members. Everything at Vanguard is a nautical theme. So I have 600 crew members who serve 5 million of our retail clients, and so that's what I've been doing for the last 4 years.
Hi, I'm Cindy Gallup, and my background is 27 years working in marketing, brand building, and advertising. These days, I'm an entrepreneur. I have two early stage web ventures. I'm redesigning the future of business at ifweranTheWorld.com, and I'm redesigning the future of sex at MakeLoveNotPorn.com and MakeLoveNotPorn.tv. Alongside my venture...
That made everybody's heads go up. Did you see that? Some people were looking at their nose and they went, whoa!
I'm so glad I got to introduce myself first. That's all I want to say.
Alongside my startups, I consult... very selectively, only for clients and brands who want to change the game in their particular sector. You come to me for radical, innovative, groundbreaking, transformative. I don't do status quo. And the way I like to sum up my consultancy approach is, I like to blow shit up. I am the Michael Bay of business.
How in the world am I going to follow that? Oh, my God.
I agree.
I would much rather talk about her sex, wouldn't you, than leadership.
Judith, you've got what it takes. She's also blowing up the world, but she's wearing St. John knit while doing it.
And Ferragamo shoes and gold. Anyway.
We have different ways of blowing up the world.
We do. So now, I'm the oldie but goodie, and that stays in this room because I lie about my age, and I always have. But I have been around a long time. I was born in North Carolina, back at a time where women were teachers, nurses, or secretaries. And I ended up going to the University of North Carolina, where I was president of the drinking club and very popular. And all of my sorority sisters went to Atlanta to find husbands. And I went to Washington, D.C. Now you're going to get a clue about my age, but it's okay. Where President Kennedy was president, and I majored in political science. I didn't know anybody, and ended up working for Walter Mondale, who was a United States senator from Minnesota. And I became his personal secretary. I had to go learn how to type. And I was the youngest personal secretary in the Senate. And back, you know, then, personal secretaries and administrative assistants were very important people. And I had a reserved place in the senator's private parking garage right next to Ted Kennedy. Now, if you don't think that didn't take the air out of the room. But anyway, I spent 10 years working for Walter Mondale, much to the chagrin of my father, who was a big Republican in Minnesota and worked for 3M Company and was head of government relations and consumer affairs, and just was, you know, too bad about this daughter, but it was a great inspiration to me that he felt that way. So I have spent 10 years in Washington during the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Revolution, as it was then. And Walter Mondale was right at the forefront of all of that. And those 10 years had the greatest impact on me of any 10 years of my life. And I met all of these incredible people. I've never had a mentor, but that experience, you know, enabled me to not ever be intimidated by anybody. And I never have been intimidated by anybody, especially these men, you know, that think they rule the world. So I did that for 10 years. Finally, everybody was married but me. I'm in my early 30s. So back then, if you weren't married, people talked about you. So I figured I can get married, and if it doesn't work out, I'll get divorced. But at least I was married once, and that would work out. Well, 40 years later, I'm still married to this guy. But let me tell you what, that's another story. I think I saw one of my children come in here, so I may have to, you know, abbreviate some of this, but to move on.
We'll talk later.
But I ended up starting this company that specialized in finding professional jobs for women back in the mid-70s where, women were, as I said, secretaries, nurses, teachers. And today, this company has grown some 38 years later to we're the largest woman-owned, retained executive search firm in the world. We're in 8 cities in the United States, 30 countries, and 60 cities worldwide. And and I guess the final thing is, and I'm talking way too much, but I'll be quiet. I also got put on public company boards when I was 40 years old because they needed token women, and Mondale was by this time vice president of the United States, so they thought I was really important, which I wasn't. And so I got the benefit of going on public company boards when I had no clue what I was doing. So I am a career woman, I am a mother, and I'm a wife.
Did I tell you that we had amazing women? We have amazing women here, and they have set the tone that they are going to be candid, authentic, honest, and go there. I love it. So let me tell you a little bit about the book to frame this up, and then we'll get into our discussion. When I first asked my then 14-year-old daughter, would you like to write a book with me about leadership, she later told me her first reaction was, I love to write. She's, you know, English is her favorite subject. She's a great writer. But leadership? She said, it kind of left a bad taste in her mouth, like, ooh, that sounds really boring. You know, I might lead a club at school, but it's just about making to-do lists. Like, how could you write a whole book about that? And so she kind of said, huh? And I said, well, we'll travel around the world, you know, we'll meet people. And she's like, okay, you know, if I get to travel, then this would be worth it. And then the first thing she said, I said, you know, we're going to do Hillary Clinton and, you know, maybe Condoleezza Rice and, you know, these political figures and business figures and CEOs. And the first thing my daughter says is, you know, if you just make it about politicians and business leaders, a lot of people are not really going to connect with it. They're really not going to think it's about them. The only thing more annoying than being challenged by your 14-year-old daughter about your sixth book is when she's right. And I immediately knew she was right, and I needed to diversify my perspective. So we ended up with people like the COO of Facebook. We did a fighter pilot and orchestra conductor. We also did the chairman of Deloitte and the head of Sony Pictures Entertainment, which really means a movie studio. So we got to go to a movie premiere, which was really cool. But we did a lot of different things. We even did a stay-at-home mom, a teenager, heads of nonprofits, Seeds of Peace, Opportunity International. So we really got a diverse perspective. We covered five continents, Hispanic, thank you, and African American, all different kinds of people in all different walks of life. And I think I'm so glad we did it that way, because part of the message of the book is that women, and what I wanted my daughter to get was that women lead everywhere. We lead in our communities, we lead in our families, we lead in businesses, we lead in government, and our leadership makes a difference. And what I wanted her to get, and I wanted all the women who read it to get, of all ages, is that sometimes leadership is so positioned as if it's something we're following the men to learn about doing, and I wanted us to feel like it's ours, and it's ours, and we do it our way, and we matter when we do it. So I'll just share with you two of the important takeaways from the book that kind of frame the discussion. One was for my daughter that the research says Gen Y girls are more positioned to close the gender gap than any group before them, any generation before them. They have more education, they have more opportunity, they have more confidence in themselves. You know, all of the things are there. Except when you interview them and you ask them, do you want the top jobs in our society? They're like, nah, it's really not me. You know, it doesn't fit. And so one of our biggest challenges as we look forward is not just breaking the glass ceilings, but turning back to the generations behind us and helping them to see that not only can they get the top jobs, they can transform what the top jobs look like, and that we need them to do that. So that's going to be part of our conversation here, is how you guys are all doing that, is you're making the jobs look different because you're sitting in the chair. The second point was, well, I guess it's similar. The orchestra conductor in Baltimore, Maren Alsop, had such a fight. And this story is kind of paralleled in other stories, but her story really crystallizes it. She had such a fight to get into her job. The conducting orchestras is one of the most sexist fields. If you think your field is bad, look at conducting orchestras. And she convinced a Japanese businessman to endow an orchestra so that she could lead it. So she got the experience. So finally, she got offered the baton in a major city in the U.S. She's the only woman conducting in a major city in the U.S. But did they offer her something that was going well? No. They offered her an orchestra that was declining attendance, in debt, donations were down. You know, everything was going wrong. Somebody said, it's not the glass ceiling, it's the glass cliff. Right? She got in, transformed it. Whenever she conducts, attendance is 10% higher. She's got every member of the orchestra volunteering in the community with disadvantaged kids in Baltimore, helping them play music, get excited about music. She's got other people in the community coming in. So she's become a model for other orchestras around the U.S. is how do you stay relevant? How do you keep the business thriving? What's a new way of doing it? And so the epiphany for me, from her and many of the others, was she had to break the mold to get to the top. She couldn't do it the same way. She says she can't even wave the baton the same way a man does. It's a whole other thing. She had to break the archetype. And the archetype for conducting is so narrow. It's the arrogant, you know, conductor. But her doing that helps innovate and strengthen the industry. And it not only paves the way for more women, it paves the way for a different kind of man. So it paves the way for more diversity on every front. And I think that's the story of a lot of what we as women are doing too. And it's important that we strengthen ourselves, that we value our differences, and even if the organizations we're going into don't always see our value, we have to help them see our value because we matter as leaders. So I'm very excited about having these three women here to bring the journey of women leaders to life for you. And as you said, you've got different perspectives, different ages, different industries, different ethnicities. She's like, easy on the age, peace. And
with
sorry,
Vanguard.
I'm sorry, can I just chip in on there? Everybody, I'm 52. I consider myself a proudly visible member of the most invisible segment of our society, which is older women. I want to help redefine what society thinks an older woman should look like, talk like, work like, be like, and date like. Sorry, I just had to say that.
We can get more into this later, but she said part of the reason why she started the website Make Love Not Porn is because she was tired of the way 20-year-old men made love. But we can get back
and to younger.
She wrote 30 Shades too.
But what's great is we have different perspectives represented. Cindy is very willing to blow up the model and change things and be very different. You're in a much more conservative industry, Alba, and so you can give us a different perspective of how a woman leads and what is expected. And you see all kinds of women leaders because you're in recruiting, and so you're seeing all kinds. So I think we have a great spectrum here. Let me start by asking, what is a mistake that you've made as a woman leader that relates to being a woman leader that you can share? I know there's mistakes you can't share, but...
So I have made so many mistakes that I had a really hard time finding one to talk about. So I decided to talk about a bucket. And that has to do with moments in my career where I have lacked self-confidence. And it basically handicapped an opportunity. And it may have been, in the context of a meeting, or it might have been in the context of implementing a strategy, or it may have been in the context of taking on an opportunity. Now, often I overcame that, but there were times where I really doubted my ability to do things. And that, I think, is something that is, not just an issue for me. I think it's an issue for women. One thing that I want to share, because I'll be making reference to this as we talk today, is that I went ahead and interviewed three awesome leaders at Vanguard for purposes of this panel. Because since the topic was how great women lead, I thought it would be, really helpful to get a composite perspective of women leadership at Vanguard, because it is a company that has a lot of fabulous women leaders who are all very different. And the issue of self-confidence came up again and again and again. And I'm talking incredibly powerful women. And so that's been a handicap for me at times. And I think it's something that I have worked on successfully, but I have to keep in check.
Thanks for being honest about that.
My biggest mistake in business, I'm not sure really derives necessarily from being a woman, although I guess a lot of people would think it does. My biggest mistake has always been when I have not fired somebody fast enough. When I have given people too many chances, again and again and again, and I have done that at different stages of my life and career, in different contexts, with different partners, co-founders, subordinates, and I've absolutely learned my lesson. You give somebody a certain number of chances, and if it's not working out, fire fast, because you will absolutely regret it if you don't.
Thank you. Very clear.
I think my problem was overconfidence. At age 40, I got put on a public company board, and I had flunked a bank, and I had flunked math twice and gotten D in economics, so you can imagine what a difficult position I found myself in. And so I decided to prove to all of them how smart I was, and I kept asking all these questions during the meeting that really probably weren't very good questions at all, and because I wanted to, impress them with how smart I was and all this kind of stuff. And this chairman came up to me afterwards, and he said, Judy, he said, we need a sidebar. I thought he was talking about furniture, but he wasn't talking about furniture. He was talking about we needed to have a little chat, that you do not ask those kind of questions and get the board all distracted on things that you're supposed to know. And so I developed a reputation early on as somebody that sort of, shot from the hip and could be trouble on a board. And I'm sure that it kept me from getting on boards for a while. I ended up getting on some, but, I probably could have had more and I could have had them sooner, but I got a reputation and I paid the price for it.
It's interesting. You were talking about confidence and underconfidence and overconfidence. And one of the studies I've read with C-suite executives from 70 different companies was identifying 8 barriers and derailers for women to get to the top. And one of them was balancing confidence with humility. Mm-hmm. And I know we talked a little bit about this ahead of time is, and you know, there's the stereotype, if we act like a man or we're too direct, we're going to get called a witch, right? Or as we said earlier, a babe in total control of herself. It's an acronym, think about it, a babe in total control of herself. Share with me an experience, if you can tell me something specific about navigating that balance between one and the other, and how would you advise them where they should be?
All right, so I said I lacked confidence at times. I never said I was humble. But actually, you know, I do think that one of the biggest lessons that I have learned at Vanguard as a leader is the lesson of humility. Because at Vanguard, humility, as one of my colleagues said, humility is a corporate standard. I mean, it is something that is a prerequisite to long-term success. And the way that that gets, you know, manifested is, and by the way, I think that, you know, from a rhetorical standpoint, I don't think you'd find anybody who would disagree with this or says it's not important. The question is that you see it in the practice day after day after day. It's the notion that the organization will be okay without you. I mean, that it will be totally okay without you, that nothing that you accomplish is because of you, but if you did anything good, it's because there were a lot of people around you that helped to get you there. It's truly working on building a cohesive, high-functioning team. Not being on a team, but working hard at making sure that that team is really powerful and effective. You know, so essentially, it's that your success depends on others and that you're not indispensable. On the other hand, though, we expect people at Vanguard to be self-confident. I mean, so it's, you have to be aggressive as well. And when I talk about aggressive, I mean you have to feel and you have to demonstrate that your being there is going to leave the wood pile higher, that you're going to make a difference. So I think confidence is about knowing that you're going to be able to make a difference and expecting yourself to make a difference. And then humility is about, you know, not being self-centered, really, and just focusing on the team. And it's a balance that I think works really well there.
Is it a different standard for men and women, though, at Vanguard?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't think so. And I believe that the women I talked to, as I mentioned, all talked about self-confidence as an area where, you know, one of the questions that I had for them is, you know, are there examples of qualities of leadership that you have to work on, you know, that you have to overcome? And one way or another, the issue of self-confidence came up. And one of them gave a great example, which is that she would be in meetings. When she was first put on these, you know, important committees that had to do with investing, our head of investing would talk about country baskets of securities. When she first said that, I'm like, what was he talking about? Then I kind of realized, oh, securities. She had no idea what it was. She wanted to ask, what on earth is a country basket? But she didn't, because she didn't want to look stupid. And then another managing director sitting right next to her said, what are country baskets? And so, you know, she realized that, hey, the questions that I'm holding back, other people are asking, and they look smart. So it was, you know, examples like that. In other words, you know, women might hold back a little more than men, but at least in Vanguard, I think that a man that is not humble may take a little longer to get him out, but he'll probably, you know, not succeed either. Yeah.
So, Cindy, you work in a very different context.
Yeah, my perspective on this derives from... So, some years ago, a survey was done of women in the workplace, which identified, unsurprisingly, that when we operate in the way that comes naturally to us as women, we are seen as weak, feminine, ineffectual. Whereas if we operate in the way that the men do, and if we play their game, we are seen as domineering, aggressive bitches. And the title of the survey was Damned If You Do, Doomed If You Don't. And the New York Times article that covered this study said, I quote, women can't win. And the fact of the matter is that we can't. So in that scenario, my advice to every woman is be the bitch. And let me explain what I mean by that. I don't mean that literally. There is never any excuse for aggressive, unpleasant behavior in the workplace, whatever your gender. But what I do mean is, if you are faced with being caught between a rock and a hard place, take the route that means you will be seen as a domineering, aggressive bitch. It doesn't mean you're being a domineering, aggressive bitch. But, you know, as the saying goes, well-behaved women rarely make history. Any woman, you know, actually bucking the trend will be seen as somebody who is aggressive and assertive. And quite frankly, that route will get you more of what you want and it'll get you more places you want to go than fading quietly into the wallpaper in a charmingly feminine way.
And I can't wait to hear Judith's perspective because you see so many different women leaders.
I do. And I grew up in an age where the Gloria Steinem, the Betty Friedans, where women feminists were burning bras and, you know, causing the revolution that's gotten us all to where we are today. So it was a totally different environment. And I chose to go another route. I chose to figure out a way to get into the kimono. I wanted the guys to like me. And I didn't think taking them on head on was the right way to do it. I thought getting them to see me as somebody that they liked, and not necessarily that I wasn't a threat, but, you know, I could get at least to a neutral place and kid them and have some fun and then go for the kill. And it's just like I played in a golf tournament yesterday, and I think there were two or three women in this tournament, and there were probably 100 men. And I won the longest drive. And the reason I won it is, wait, let me tell you what. The reason I won it is because the ladies' tees were 100 yards ahead of the men's tees. But they were more impressed with that. And I know that did me more good than anything I could have done, you know, working the crowd there with those boys. And so my approach has always been to be proud to be a woman. And I used to talk a lot about these women, and I'm so glad not to see it today, that everybody shows up in a pinstriped suit and pants with a handkerchief to try to look just like a man. Why in the world would you want to do that? I mean, why not be proud to be a woman? Wear skirts, wear bright colors. I mean, show off yourself. I'm not saying to be inappropriately sexy. Now, she may disagree with me about that. But you want to be noticed. You flat out want to be noticed when you come into a room. And men, believe it or not, they still like women. And, you know, you need to work it in a way that it's going to work for you. And I'm telling you, it can get you there so much faster, I think.
Don't you love we're hearing so many different perspectives, and it's not even the words they're saying, it's who they are that just speaks really loud and says, see, there's different ways to do this, we can be successful, we can reinvent the game on our own terms, and that is so much the message that we wanted to get through with the book. One of the things we saw over and over in the book was women talking about delegating, and I think our brains are wired to be more detail-oriented, and so we have a harder time letting go of the details. We can be more perfectionists, and studies show all this. And one way of talking about that is leading versus managing, and Sharon Allen, the chairman of Deloitte, talked about how somebody told her, you're a better leader in Portland than you are in Boise. You know, how can a person be a better leader in one city than another? And it was because in Boise, her career had grown up there. She knew all the details. She was hanging on to too much. And in Portland, she was forced to lead by working through other people, by not being so in the weeds. What insight can you give us about that struggle, about learning to step into leadership as a woman?
I love that I always get to go first because they're so compelling. That makes me sound better.
Oh, you're compelling too, and
kidding,
we love
I'm
your perspective.
Kidding.
See, this is that. Wait. She just did that confidence thing, didn't she?
No, I didn't. That was humor. That was humor. So I think that absolutely it's an issue, and it may be more of an issue for women because we, not to, you know, typecast, tend to be nurturing and care a lot about people. And by the way, I think that that's an awesome trait of leadership as far as, you know, how great women lead. And you know, one theme is that caring, nurturing streak that women have, I think, is a huge advantage when it comes to leadership. At the same time, what happens when you move from management to leadership is that, you know, you can't possibly know all the facts about everything and still keep an eye on the big picture. And I think being a leader is really understanding how your job or your organization or your function fits into the broader goal of an organization. So kind of think broad, think wide, think about the connection between what you do and the ultimate goal of an organization as opposed to managing within a unit. And that means trade-offs. That means you have to give up decision-making. And so that means you have to put in a team in place that you are going to trust. And so all of those are frankly, you know, so what's this book? What got you here doesn't get you there. I mean, you have to, you know, if you got to leadership because you made amazingly strong decisions, then you immediately have to pivot and let somebody else make those decisions for you. So I think if I were to say, you know, three critical things that help people successfully transition from being a manager to a leader. And again, this is in part, you know, talking to these other awesome women that I got to talk about. Is number one, anchor yourself in the big picture of your company or your nonprofit or your organization and connect what you do to that. Number two, pick an amazing team that you can trust. And number three, let go of decisions.
What I just have to say, what I love about that too is we struggle as women so much with work-life issues and the competing for our time. And if we can go into leadership, we can let go of more of the detail, we can balance more. And so many women are afraid to step up to leadership because they think they're going to be doing 10 times as much as they are now. But they don't understand you have to let go as you go higher.
I've got a slightly different perspective on that. Business.
How shocking.
Surprise! Surprise! So business currently is a male-centric construct. And that's because for centuries we weren't allowed to do it. And so it has grown up around a male leadership model of command and control, male business values. The entire corporate structure is built around the concept of the housewife. The entire corporate world grew up predicated on the idea that only men worked and you had a woman at home to take care of everything else. And that has changed, but the fundamental structure of corporations hasn't. So I believe in redesigning business. For example, I would like to see the corporate structure completely redesigned around parenting as something both genders do equally, as opposed to what we currently see as stick-on solutions for motherhood. We have a creche, we have flexible working hours for women. And so I think what we are seeing is absolutely the emergence of a world where we have the opportunity to redesign what business looks like and how it operates. And already business itself is being redesigned around a female leadership model that is about everything that we're great at: collaboration, consensus building, community. And so in a way, I think the divide between leading and managing becomes more artificial when you look at it in the context of a male-centric business world. When you look at a business world that we inform, that we design, I think it would look very different. Our model of leadership looks very different, and I think our model of leadership is management in a way that we are particularly great at doing, which, by the way, has the potential to create and design a business world for the future that men would be much, much happier operating in. And they don't realize that because they've never seen what that looks like, but they would have much happier working lives in a world that was equally informed and designed by both men and women.
We really saw it with Eileen Fisher too. We were interviewing Sharon Allen, and she was talking about what the company would look like in the future, and Darcy and I both turned to each other in that moment and said, Eileen Fisher. And because she built her own company from the ground up, the org chart looks different. It looks like a ball of string. It's not a bunch of silos, you know.
It's not
very
status.
Connected.
Yeah.
And the whole way it's organized. So that was one example of us getting to look inside and go, this is what a woman-centric company looks like. And one that's truly blended, male and female, would look different again, I think. Mm.
I actually agree with some of the stuff she said. I'm getting a little, makes me nervous. I was in the ladies' room just before we came up here, and I was sitting in my stall, you know, trying to get relaxed, and I heard these two women talking, you know, in the stalls next to me, and they obviously work at the same company. And they were talking about, one was saying to the other, I'm so excited, I now work for Sharon. She is awesome. And they were talking about, you know, how excited they were that they were working for a woman. And I thought, you know, that's just really neat. You know, we see lots of women in the work that I do today. We do searches for top leadership in all industries and all sectors. And so, and today there's this huge press to have diversity in all of the candidate pools that we present to our clients. You know, you cannot be in the retained executive search business today and expect to get a lot of repeat business if you don't have a strong track record with diversity. We have a board of directors practice that focuses just on getting women and minorities on public company boards. And so, you know, diversity goes in these pendulums, and it's in now. Let's hope it stays for a while. And how about that woman that just had a baby that went from Google to Yahoo? I mean, how awesome. I mean, 38 years old, and I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need to see today. And we need to see, you know, Fortune's 50 top powerful women and Wall Street Journal, and the media is, you know, on a roll now, and they're really interested in, you know, highlighting women that are achieving. And these women are achieving because they're prepared, they're getting the job done, and the white men wish them well and are supportive of them. So, I think that the whole environment's changing. But I think one of the things that women leaders can do and should do, and maybe it's part of being a woman, but it's taking a strong stand on things such as integrity and character and, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And, you know, being known for that and speaking up, you know, in your company and in organizations and where you are, when you see things that just aren't right, don't be, you know, not to be afraid to do that, because other people see it and they're thinking it. And, you know, you really admire people that have the courage to do that. And so the idea is, as I said before, to call attention to yourself in a variety of ways. And I think you should always be, you know, looking for those opportunities. But, I mean, that's something that's just innate within us as women. I mean, you know, you can't fool us. So, you know what? You're going to have to be accountable.
I love it. Anybody who can wear St. John knit and start their pithy remarks, valuable remarks with, I was sitting in the stall and I heard next door. So I don't know, when you fill out your reviews on this session, you have to say this was the funnest session, right? We had the most fun. Love it. I know, Alba, when you talked to some of your other leaders at Vanguard, relationships was one of the things that came up. And one of the things I see with a lot of the companies I work with, developing women leaders, is that we are not as good at networking as men. And doesn't that just make you mad? I mean, we're better at relationships, we care more. How could we not be better at networking? Some of the studies say that men create relationships on a much shallower level. So they're comfortable having 1,000-inch deep relationships, whereas we think if we didn't call somebody last month, they're not our friend anymore, right? And they also trade on those relationships. So they met you at a cocktail party, they'll call you up the next day and ask you for a favor for, you know, meeting somebody or doing something or whatever. And we're like afraid to ask anything. So is that important for us as women to get better at broadening our relationships and changing the way we do that, being able to ask for favors through our relationships?
I think it's absolutely essential, and especially for women in positions of leadership, you know, the broader your network, the greater diversity of perspective and insight you will have. And I think it's also, we have a mutual friend, Molly Shepherd, who is an expert, and I know you're really good at, you know, coaching women as well on how to not only have a network, but leverage your network. And so it's really about using it. So I will say that you know, the higher you go into an organization, or, you know, when you get new opportunities, there's probably, you know, a million things you don't know for every, you know, 1,000 you do know. And so your relationships and your network and your ability and your drive to connect with people, you know, and get their perspective and their insight is going to be critical to your success. And I'm not sure if I always see that, you know, that women don't have broad networks, but I think I do see sometimes that men have less of guilt. I saw this a lot at United Way, you know, where we had a lot of men CEOs that I was surrounded by, and they have much less guilt about picking up the phone, and asking somebody for a favor that they haven't spoken to in forever. You know, if it's women, we feel like we got to invite them out to coffee, have dinner. Oh, I'm so sorry I didn't call you before. You know, have an hour-long conversation. So there might be a little bit of a sense of obligation there or guilt that we just need to keep in check.
We have a huge opportunity on the networking front that I don't observe enough women taking advantage of, which is the opportunity to build our own networks. And I've seen this firsthand because I'm fortunate enough to be on an email list, a listserv, for women in tech, which was started about 2 years ago by a wonderful woman based in New York called Rachel Sklar, who is the founder of the movement Change the Ratio. The tagline is, we love women, we love men, we just don't love the ratio. And we call out with a Change the Ratio hashtag every conference with an all-male or male-dominated speaker lineup, you know, every event that is, you know, focused on men, every example in the tech world, that the assumption is that a geek or a hacker is always male, et cetera, et cetera. But this email list has grown over the past couple of years from originally about 30 of us to, I guess it must be something like, you know, 350, 400 strong. It's got a whole range of female entrepreneurs, media people, VCs on it. And what we have done is that we have built up our own girls' club that operates in the way the boys' club does. So any member of this list, you know, will say to us an email, you know, I've just published this book. Here are the tweets. Here is the Amazon link. Please go and review it. Please put it out on social media. Please help me get it out there. And we help each other and we champion each other. You know, people circulate job opportunities, speaking opportunities, and also people share triumphs and they share failures. People share moments of weakness. People will say on the list, you know, today I'm feeling like absolute crap. This happened, that happened, and we all share our same weaknesses. We shore each other up. And that list has become so powerful that Rachel has now gotten a grant from the Knight Foundation to take it forward as the list, as something that she wants to extend out globally to help women everywhere. And so what we absolutely don't think about proactively and consciously enough is how can we help lift each other up on all our shoulders in the way that men do naturally and unthinkingly. And every one of you within your immediate circle, let alone networking a conference like this, has the opportunity to do that. Do the things the boys do that we've envied for years, and let's push all of ourselves up on the back of that.
Well, I think that women have made enormous strides in terms of building networks and coming together. Back in my day, nobody wished us well. The sisters, you know, everybody was out for themselves, and it was unbelievable. And we really didn't help each other, and we were jealous or envious and suspicious and all of that. And it's just so great to see. I was part of helping to start the Forum of Executive Women here 35 years ago, and it's one of the biggest, you know, women's organizations of professionals, you know, in the country, and the things they do are just enormous. But I think that the networks have to go beyond just the women's organizations, and I chose to get involved in the Chamber of Commerce because, you know, that's about business, and that's where all the business leaders are, and it's definitely male-dominated. And I ended up, you know, I got on the board and I became the chair. I was the second woman chair, I think. And, you know, it has been probably the most valuable networking opportunity that I have because I get to see, you know, all the powers that be in their, you know, in their suits. And but I think that, you know, you have to go beyond just the women's networks, and you've got to pick the right ones. I mean, there's some of these not-for-profit organizations that while they are well-meaning in what they do, they're a total waste of time if you're trying to build networks. And so you just have to separate that out. There's some things you do because you have passion, you feel it in your heart, but if you're trying to develop your power and influence in the community, you need to look at it differently.
I'm going to make a call to action on this point is, something that I've been doing lately is whenever I find myself at a small table of women, like I'm around five or six women, I kind of make a challenge and say, you know, we don't do this. We don't ask each other for favors because we don't know each other well enough. So let's break that right here and now. So I challenge you at lunch. You're going to be sitting at a table full of women. Make the comment, oh, we were in a session where we learned women don't ask each other for favors because we don't, you know each other. So you're at lunch, we'll know each other an inch deep, and you will ask each other for favors. Are you in? Who's in? Okay.
Great idea.
Great. So let's break this trend that we're
don't
talking about.
Don't ask me
right
for
now.
A job, though.
Well, you know, it's okay. When somebody asks you for favors, it's okay to say no, or I can't give you a job, but can I help you with this? You know, you can redirect the favor, you can downsize the favor, you can find a favor that you can give. And if people at the table can just express what it is they need, different people will jump in with whatever they have to offer. So you give people that flexibility. We're going to open it up for questions. Do people have questions that they want to ask the panel? Can you come up to the mic? Why don't you just line up at the mic? There's a mic here. There's three mics. If you have a question, start lining up at the mics, okay? Oh, come on. You guys have questions. These are great folks. This is your chance.
Hello.
What's your name and what's your question?
My name is Deanne Cox, and my question is in regard to the networking. What are your thoughts about women being like crabs in a barrel? I heard someone say that Judith, back in your time, women really, it was like a cat fight, and I still feel that way, and I've been in various career fields, so what do you feel about the crab in a barrel theory when it comes to women?
I say you're hanging out with the wrong women. Seriously, find another group of friends. Ton of women who are unbelievably supportive, and I think sometimes we surround ourselves with the wrong people, and you want to surround yourself with people who have your back, and who support you, and who will tell you to. I mean, sometimes, I'm not saying that this is the case, but sometimes people have to tell us, you know, things that are hard to hear, and we can't interpret that the wrong way. You know, sometimes we're not good at things. Or sometimes, you know, some things are harder for us than others. So I think, you know, that being said, if you have, you know, if they're real friends, they are going to sometimes tell you stuff you don't want to hear. But if you feel that they don't have your back, you really need to find a group of other friends, because I think there's plenty of women out there who are going to be invested in your success.
Great answer.
And you could ask Judith for some names of those women when you go up to her and ask her for a favor.
Back at you, honey. I totally agree with what she said.
Next, should we go to the next question? You good?
Next. Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead.
I recently discovered that I'm not getting responses in my particular field that I do. I host events. And I created a profile as a white man. And I asked the same, I formed the same question, actually more formal as a woman, and then I didn't get a response. And then as the white man under my profile, I got a response in like 2 minutes, and it was very informal, and it happened at least 3 times in the past month or so.
What's your question?
How do I handle that? I think I should, I say exposure equals closure, and it's very discouraging to try, because the things I do are fundraising, nonprofit. So it's very discouraging to try and do something positive when my voice is not heard as woman.
That's deep, what she's asking. Judith Gordon, you answer it, Cindy.
That's appalling. It's absolutely outrageous. I mean, it is also, sadly, as we all know, all too often the case. I think what I would say is, and this is just my perspective, but we know that's the case. I would just set it aside. Actually, I wouldn't do anything further about it. I would just think about it as another one of those obstacles that you have to overcome, that we all have to overcome. You know, and they're different obstacles, whether they are born out of, you know, prejudice, or whether they're just born out of being an entrepreneur and working for ourselves. If you know that what you're doing is bloody brilliant, just get out there and project it with the confidence that you have. And what I would recommend you do is, you know, there are there are too many white guy or white woman outfits doing the same kind of thing. What is it about yours that is uniquely different? You know, almost use that ridiculous conventional mindset to transcend it. You know, what do you do that's unique that only you bring to the table, and get even more overt and strong and confident about that? People value you at the value you seem to put in yourself. And I have to tell you that... In your business area of, you know, event organization, it's a highly competitive one. The people who will stand out are the people who are doing things differently. So too many sectors fall into that trap of collaborative competition. Collaborative competition is where everybody in a sector competes with everybody else in the sector by doing exactly the same thing everybody else in the sector is doing. Let the anger you feel at that fact you've just discovered fire you up to go, okay, I'm going to do things my way. Because I'm different, and I'm going to be different in a positive sense. What can I do that will elevate me above the competition? You know, because actually, you know, again, in your sector, there's a huge opportunity in the fact that everybody approaches doing business in the same way. So I take that anger and I channel it into something positive. I wouldn't get sidetracked by what is a fact of life that we are going to change. Over time, we're all going to change that. Just take it and use it positively.
I just want to underline what you're saying with the comment. I was moderating a different panel, and there was a woman on the panel who was in the financial services and has done really well and raised million-dollar funds and everything. And she said, I finally became successful when I stopped trying to be the best white guy in the room. So you can take that as a summary of what she said.
Absolutely.
Stop trying to be the
best
white guy in the room.
Yeah.
Okay, we need another question.
Thank you.
Thank you. You go ahead.
Okay.
We'll take you.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Brickhouse, and the question that I have is really around how do you get to the next level. To give you a little bit of background, I'm in the IT field, been in the field for about 10 years, and I'm at kind of a impasse where I'm doing all the things that you need to do in order to get to the next level. I'm actually performing at that next level when you think about like, director level positions and things like that. I'm doing that. I've done the mentoring. I've done the coaching, everything else. But for some reason, you're just not getting there. So what are some ideas or thoughts that you might have to really get to that next level? Because I can't apply for any some of the positions that maybe Judith might have because you need to be at that level to move forward. So when you're in that in-between state, what are some suggestions you have really to kind of break through?
I would say that, first of all, you got to let the powers that be know that you're interested in knowing about opportunities, your boss and his boss and whatever. And then, you know, I think you need to test the waters. I mean, you need to talk to folks confidentially, and everybody does it, believe me, all the time. They call people like me and my competitors and whatnot, and you need to make those relationships so that you see what's out there in the job market for somebody like you so that you've got something to... You know, you may have a really good situation, better than you think, or it may be so out of step with what's going on. But, you know, you need to find that out, and then you can figure out how to best leverage it.
Great. Thank you. Let's get over here. What is your name? What's your question?
My name is not on.
I'll repeat it for you if you want.
I can project. My name is Lucy, and I'm essentially really, really young. I'm 22, and I'm one of the youngest people in my department, in my building, where I currently am.
In this room, probably.
But I do have a lot of goals. Now, what I find, especially with the four of you having so different perspectives coming from different areas, we all face the same things. But looking back, what would be your advice to someone in my position? Because I have a lot of friends who are in the same position who don't get the opportunity to come here and meet different women, meet different people from other walks of life, and get some advice on how to break out of the stigma of being a woman, a young woman, in a male-dominated area. Well, I work for the government, so.
Who wants to take this one? Make it quick so we can get one more question.
Sure. So I would say that being 22, being a woman, being in you know, a position where it sounds like you have, you know, opportunity if you capitalize on it, it's a huge advantage. And, you know, all you have ahead of you is runway. You know, because of your age, you can afford to make more mistakes than people who are, you know, older and, you know, live to see the other side of it. So I would totally look at your situation and take a real positive attitude around it and say, wow, what an incredible advantage. And, you know, my advice, not knowing what you do, is, you know, strive to be the best at what you do. You know, put your head down, any task you have, you know, strive to be the best. And I think that, frankly, you know, given your energy and given your drive to get ahead, you know, will get you ahead. But look at your circumstances as an opportunity, and then I think that projects out.
Can I just add something to that? You're very lucky to be 22 right now. And the reason I say that is because we are at a moment where everything is breaking down completely. The old world order is dying and the new world order is being born. And that wasn't the case when I was 22 and working in my first job. So I can tell you that everybody in your government organization, at the different levels above you, they're scared shitless. They are.
That's what you really think.
Yeah. They are insecure. They're petrified. You bring a completely fresh perspective to your organization, your business. Decide what you would do with your organization, your business, and then tell them. As Albus says, you've got nothing to lose. You're at the start of your career. Your fresh eyes on what they're doing could bring some really, really valuable, interesting advice. Absolutely, put it together in the way to be best received as a presentation, a document, find the right person. But think about how you would like to change the organization you're working in, what you would like to do, tell them and see what happens. And you might be pleasantly surprised.
And start a digital business on the side. What's your question?
Good afternoon. Kathy Mandarino. And I loved the conversation about confidence, whether it was overconfidence or underconfidence. And I really think that at whatever level in leadership or striving to leadership is people suffer those anxieties of confidence that can be barriers or can be opportunities. My question to each of the panelists is just one point. When you find yourself in that situation, a specific kind of what I do to get over it or what I do to project that confidence or to get around the crisis in confidence, I think would be a very good takeaway for each of us.
Can we do one sentence answers for each person and then we're going to have to wrap up?
I have a glass of wine and go for the most important person in the room to try to have a conversation.
The single best moment in my life was the moment I realized I no longer gave a damn what anybody thought. I know it's really, really hard to get to that point, but seriously, at that crisis of confidence, tell yourself, I don't care what they think, I'm going to do what's right for me.
I'll boil it down to one word, which is, in the context where this is relevant, preparation. Preparation.
As the one-legged black woman in the room, I've always been stared at. I stand a little straighter, look them direct in the eye, and smile like Miss America.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So what an amazing panel. You were right. We didn't expect this, and it was awesome. And thank you so much.